Hey folks, thanks for being a member of the Cafe Insider community. In addition to the Cafe Insider podcast and my weekly note, you also get bonus material from my interviews on Stay Tuned with Preet. This is exclusively for you. Hope you enjoy it. You know, a lot of what you talk about is this issue of how you get people to open up, right? Particularly in informal relationships and informal contexts. And on one issue that we touched upon, racism, it's a natural inclination if you were to come across a racist or come across a racist group to want to preach to them, to want to lecture them, to want to prosecute them, right? In both the informal and maybe even the formal sense, because the views are odious. You come across, you know, a grand wizard of the KKK at a bar, the first inclination of someone who is fair-minded, I think, as you and I are, would not be to try to understand where they're coming from, but would be to excoriate them for having such odious, terrible views. And that's how I think a lot of people think about it. You tell the story of someone who I've actually otherwise admired for a long time, that maybe a lot of people don't know about, a gentleman by the name of Darryl Davis, who's a Black man who has had precisely these interactions with white supremacists. Can you describe him a little bit and how he has been successful in changing people's minds?
Yeah, Darryl Davis is a Black musician who I think first in the early 1980s went to play a gig in a room full of white people. And afterward, a man came up and was just stunned that his music reminded him, I guess, of Jerry Lee Lewis. And Darryl Davis said, we're actually friends. You know, he's been a big influence on me. And he told me that Black musicians were a big influence on him. And the guy could not believe it. And they got to talking. The guy was a big music fan. And it turned out that the guy was a card-carrying member of the KKK. And instead of preaching, instead of prosecuting, instead of walking away, which he would have been well within his rights, and frankly, I think anybody I know would have done, Darryl got curious.
Yeah, might have taken a swing.
I mean, yeah, it's unbelievable that he had the presence of mind and also the courage to engage this conversation, but he just posed a question that had been on his mind since he was 10 years old, the first time he can remember facing racism, which is, how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Pretty basic question.
It's one of the most powerful questions I think anybody could be asked. And it's pretty hard to come up with a compelling answer to it.
But it's not a one-off, right?
No, it's an ongoing conversation.
But for Darryl Davis, he has continued to meet with, connect with, and talk to not just sort of mild racists, not just sort of people who have unconscious bias in the workplace. He's not doing, as far as I know, trainings in corporate. He's engaging with hardcore card-carrying members of the KKK and getting them to give up their robes.
Not only that, but they've given him their robes. They've made him the godfather to their children. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I think the first thing that needs to be established here is that this should not be Darryl Davis's responsibility as a Black man, right? To go and educate white supremacists. We should have entire structures, systems, cultural institutions to accomplish this, ideally led by white people who are not putting themselves at the same level of risk when they go and do that as the very real danger that Darryl Davis is entering into. But, you know, he chooses to do it. He's extraordinarily effective at it. And I think there's a lot we can learn from him. And one of the most memorable moments for me is when he sits down with the titles are just hard to fathom. An Exalted Cyclops.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to tell this anecdote because I have my book turned to page 139 where you talk about
it. All right, well, you start it and I'll elaborate.
Well, so one example. So you think to yourself in the abstract, well, how are you going to convince someone who is a grand wizard or the Exalted Cyclops to reflect upon the error of their stereotyping ways, right? And then you provide an example. Darryl's driving his car with the chief officer of a KKK chapter, whose, as you said, official title was Exalted Cyclops. And his view, the Exalted Cyclops guy, was that Black people were inferior. They were an inferior species, in fact. He said they had smaller brains, which made them unintelligent, and a genetic predisposition toward violence. When Darryl pointed out that he was Black, but had never shot anyone or stolen a car, the Cyclops told him his criminal gene must be latent. It just hadn't come out yet. And what is, well, I mean, wow, that's a crazy scene, not from a movie. And then how does Daryl respond?
Yeah. I mean, Daryl is such... I really don't know how to teach this level of equanimity or the improvisational genius that this took. But he basically, instead of arguing, instead of, you know, I can't think of a more ridiculous point of view to prosecute, Daryl decides to play the game. And he says to the Cyclops, well, can you name 3 black serial killers?
Right.
And the Cyclops can't name any. And then Daryl has a whole list of, you know, very familiar white serial killers. And he says to the Cyclops, well, you must be one of them. And the Cyclops says, no, I'm not a serial killer. I haven't killed anybody. And Daryl says, well, your gene must be latent. Hasn't come out yet.
Must be latent. So what is the lesson to learn from Daryl Davis? And, you know, I have also written about extraordinary people who go above and beyond that it's hard for folks to emulate. I mean, is it the responsibility of everyone who's not a racist to go to the lengths that Daryl Davis goes to and try to convince people of the error of their ways and how to be fair and impartial to people based on their race or background or gender or anything else? He's extraordinary, as you point out multiple times, and as these stories indicate. Are we supposed to be like that?
I don't think it's my place to judge, right? Or to tell anyone, you know, where they should draw their moral lines. But I do think that a lot of us have rethought our responsibilities for anti-racism in the past year and for fighting systemic injustice, especially in the wake of the George Floyd murder. And I think that for anybody who wants to try to get people who hold hateful views or prejudice to rethink those, the place to start, obviously, is turning the lens inward and saying, okay, are you stereotyping 74 million Trump supporters? Have you really understood what motivated them to cast the votes they did?
People get very angry when people make statements like that, because their response is, well, they're doing the same to us. They're doing the same to us. And it probably strikes some people as odd, but then maybe we're opening people's minds to this in the same way that you described by talking about Daryl Davis, that, you know, people who are not racist are supposed to be go above and beyond and be, to use the word you just used a second ago, so magnanimous and open-minded and empathetic as to embrace the racists so as to convince them that what they should have known from the time of youth is odious and horrible and terrible and harmful to society. You know, people don't want to sign up for that.
No, and I don't blame them. I mean, I'm not going out and trying to convert KKK members into beliefs that I think are reasonable and moral. But I do think, you know, I've seen a lot of pushback about this, especially post-insurrection. And what I want to know is, what is the alternative? Like, my job as a social scientist is to ask what's effective. And if you want to stop hate, if you want to fight racism, then we all have a responsibility to learn what actually opens people's minds. In the same way that you could say, you know what? It's a lot of work to arrest people and charge them with crimes and put them in jail. And, you know, I don't really want to be doing that, but to have a civil society, we've decided this is important. And I guess I look at opening people's minds the same way. You know, the lesson from Daryl for me is that he engages these conversations with humility and curiosity. He does a version of what psychologists would call motivational interviewing, which is to recognize that you can't force someone to change their mind. And you're not going to get very far bullying them or even logic bullying them to try to change their mind. What you want to do is try to help them find their own motivation to change. And that, you know, I think in a lot of cases means asking questions about how they got to where they are and what would lead them to shift. So, you know, if I were engaging somebody on the opposite end of the political spectrum, I would start by saying, you know, tell me about the key moments that led you to support Donald Trump. And then tell me what would have to happen in order to shift your allegiance. And by the way, you know, just to give you a sense of my stance, I believe that our highest loyalty is to principles, not to people. I think that's part of it's at least an implicit message of the Constitution. And so, you know, I'm sure you have some values that are so important that if a leader were to violate them, that you would withdraw your loyalty from that leader out of loyalty to those higher principles. So tell me a little bit about what those are and help me understand them. And then the hope is that you'll begin to identify, you know, something that you hold allegiance to that's greater than than the leader that you're voting for. And then we can start to have an open-minded conversation or a little bit less closed-minded conversation.
I mean, part of your point is that people need to find their own reasons to change. And the way that people find their own reasons to change is not to be hectored or lectured at, but to be asked questions that reveal to them they don't have good reasons, right? Because many people have lots of belief systems that are really houses of cards. And they had a knee-jerk reaction because of an experience they had, or a story they heard, or a TV show they watched, or their parents drummed it into them. And so they take it as an article of faith. It's never been tested. I mean, that's true, by the way, of less odious belief systems other than racism too. People very quickly, and you know this better than anybody, form attachments to points of view that don't have any founding at all. And the best way to get them to undo that is for them to take the time and effort through a process of self-reflection. That point of view is based on nothing.
I love the way you just articulated that. The mental image I have whenever I read this research is you've got somebody with a Jenga tower in their head.
Right.
In their head, it's their belief system. And, you know, they think that the foundations are all steady and that every single row of the Jenga tower has the three blocks. But actually, a bunch of blocks are missing and it's kind of wobbly. And if you try to yank one of those blocks out, they're gonna hold on to the rest of them for dear life and push it back in. If you can get them to pull out the right block, they will knock down their own tower and then start to rebuild it, I hope, on a sturdier foundation of, you know, of data and logic. And I think that it's so hard to resist the temptation. This is kind of my biggest curse as an organizational psychologist is, you know, my job is to bring people data to help them think again. And when I see somebody who believes something that is just inconsistent with decades of good scientific research, I think it's my responsibility to correct them and educate them.
And you lose your mind a little bit, right, Adam?
Yeah. I mean, it's maddening. Like, what? Like, I had an interaction with a senior executive once that really embarrassed me, where, like, I was trying to get him to treat his employees reasonably well. And he basically said, people can't be trusted. Like, you have to micromanage them or they won't deliver. And
nice accent, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I've been practicing for years. No, I started bringing him a bunch of data, and he said, "Well, that's not what my experience has shown." And I'm like, "Yes, that's why I ran randomized controlled experiments, and I did longitudinal studies of real people in a lot of different jobs, so that I could learn systematically from rigorous evidence instead of idiosyncratically from your personal experience." And it just, you know, he just kept pushing back and it didn't go anywhere. And eventually I told him that I'd never seen a group of smart people act so dumb. Right. Not my proudest moment.
How did that go?
You know, it's funny. I got feedback about a year later that was the most important thing I said in the meeting, because it's so unusual for anybody to call them out on, you know, on making irrational decisions. But, you know, it's still embarrassing for me, and it's certainly not how I want to communicate and persuade. And so I came out of that and said, all right, when somebody doesn't believe my data, instead of going into prosecutor mode or logic bully mode, I'm just going to ask two questions. The first one is, like, if you don't value my perspective, why in the world are you talking to me? Like, why did you hire me if you don't think my data are compelling? And then more importantly, the second one is, what evidence would change your mind?
Thank you again for becoming a Cafe Insider. Listen to the Cafe Insider podcast every Tuesday with Ann Milgram and me, and stay tuned every Thursday.